Welcome to the hour of We the People right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your jazz and justice station for over 49 years, because we are entirely listener supported. It means listeners like yourselves choose to give us the financial wherewithal and the social connectivity to bring you jazz and justice, each broadcast trying to build a better community, one broadcast at a time. I'm David Whetstone, your host for this hour. Again, the program's We the People. And if you're new to the program, We the People is a weekly news magazine that deals with the issues of race, history, politics, and culture, particularly where they intersect, and with an emphasis on present and previous efforts and future casting as far as what we can do when those issues intersect and affect our lives. We honor individuals and groups, whether it's doctors, lawyers, advocates, scholars, community activists, grassroots leaders, teachers, people from all walks of life, young and old, of various backgrounds, have purpose to make our lives better, and we honor that in this hour. Often, the story of place affects us human beings. It affects our families, our communities. Washington, D.C. is such a place. And we're going to talk to a guest about her family with the topic, Numbers Up, Cracking the Code of an American Family. It's the story of the impact of policy and criminal justice systems upon a Washington, D.C. family. Our guest is Janisa Matthews-Levy, and she's a lawyer, but she's also a nonprofit development professional, and with the matter of law, a former litigation attorney. Her writing has appeared in WildSam, TheKitchen.com, Northern Virginia Magazine, and Yes Media. She received her BA from Harvard University and her JD from the New York University School of Law. Her memoir, Numbers Up, Cracking the Code of an American Family, is indeed the basis of our conversation. Welcome and good morning.
Thank you for having me, David. I'm really excited to be here and just want to share that this is the 1 year anniversary of Numbers Up. It was published last year on June 17th.
Okay, so it's been around, it's been read, and you gracefully share the story of your family in a period of Washington, D.C. that I hope readers will find most interesting. Just give us a preamble, an introduction. What is as we listen through this hour, what is the thrust of the story, or what is it that you want us to navigate? And what put you onto that undertaking to start off with?
Yeah, so the genesis of Numbers Up was actually a few years after my parents passed away. And it was actually during COVID when, you know, I know a lot of people can relate when they lose a family member that it sometimes takes them a while to be able to, you know, emotionally handle like some of the objects and papers and such that your loved one has. So I had kind of put those things aside and had this extra time, and I was looking through my mother's collection. She has quite a collection of memorabilia and documents, and I found my father's parol paper. And for the first time, I realized that my father was actually not present during my birth. He was incarcerated in Lorton. So this kind of opened up a lot of questions for me, because it was the first time I had realized that. But I also knew that he ran the numbers in DC for a very long time. And so I kind of just wanted to explore that. I think because I was born during this very difficult time for my family, they shielded me from a lot of things, and they didn't share a lot of things with me. And I think there was a bit of a protective aspect to that, but also possibly a stigma. And so I just wanted to honor, you know, my father, what he did to be able to support his very large family during a difficult time. He grew up in Jim Crow, was born in, you know, 1924, was a World War II vet. And so I kind of leave this, I feel like it's a little bit of a love letter to DC and a love letter to my family, and especially my parents.
And just to get in some of our minds, the time that straight, what was the period of the numbers running that he did?
I don't know exactly when he started running numbers, but I would suspect that it was, you know, it started in the 50s and 60s, and certainly continued into my high school years at that point, and that was in the 1990s. At that point, it was a failing business because we had the, you know, lotteries come in and they were competing with the numbers. And so it, you know, it was a very long career for him. You know, he was somebody who came back from World War II and wasn't afforded, you know, the benefits of the GI Bill, you know, insured mortgages and such, as you know, that's the story of a lot of Black families. So he had to kind of make his way in the extra legal economy, and he was very successful at it until the competition came in with the state lotteries.
Ah, okay. Well, two preliminary questions. You mentioned that you discovered a document that indicated that he was on, that he encountered the criminal justice system. I'll let you fill that out.
Yes.
However you want to.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And maybe give our listeners an understanding of your curiosity and pursuit. Like, how long did it take, to put this all together? How long did you dedicate? And I imagine you're still dedicating yourself to somewhat of a journey. So I've smashed a few questions together there.
Yeah, no, the paper I discovered was his parole paper. I was born in August 1977, so he was paroled in September 1977. So right away, that was a flag for me, because I had always, it had always been represented to me that my father was, you know, there for this birth and homecoming. And, you know, my mother even went so far as to like write that in my baby album. But, you know, I later found the pictures of my actual homecoming, and like, it's sometimes with pictures, it's like who and what is not in the picture tells you a lot. So he was not there. So I think because I knew about the numbers, but I knew that we had to be very careful. I remember my father telling me when I got a call at the house, somebody was asking for him and they wanted to play a number. And I was a little girl, I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I went to him and I told him, and then he was said, don't ever take a call like that again. And, you know, he was very like stern. I could tell he was mad at me, but he was mad at the situation. So I kind of knew right away, like, there's something about this. So I started putting the pieces together, you know, and I found out that, it was a bust of a numbers ring that started with a notable DC figure called Odessa Madre, who, you know, she had Club Madre and she had a lot of properties and she had a very diversified business profile. You know, she had these clubs, she ran the numbers. I believe she had a brothel. And so she was the original target of the investigation. And this was in 1973.
And designated target by whom? I want to just...
The FBI. Okay. The FBI. They thought that, you know, they wanted to target her for narcotics. And so they got, you know, pen registers and then they got wiretaps on her. But instead they were finding a lot of gambling activity. So at that point, they turned it over to the DC police. And that's how my dad ended up getting ensnared in this whole thing.
Okay. And for those of us who are not lawyers, I just noted a little thing. What's a pen register for our listeners?
If you can, yeah. So a pen register is different than a wiretap. So it will show you the numbers that are actually calling. So you can kind of see like a pattern of, you know, who is communicating with who. And so it's kind of like it was a preliminary step in that investigation. And just to answer your other question about how long it took me, it took me about 2 years to write this book. And then, you know, I was probably still editing after that, and it took a while to get a publisher and all that. But you know, my first step was really to go to my dad's attorney and to get some of those legal records and kind of start, you know, the lawyer and me putting together the elements, and then asking certain family members who had some remembrances of that time. And, you know, my other siblings, some of them were teenagers, so they remembered some things, but they didn't really understand how all of it worked together. So it was a little bit of like a detective or investigative aspect to writing this book.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Janisha Matthews-Levy, and we're in conversation through the basis of her book, Numbers Up, Cracking the Code of an American Family. It's a story of a Washington, D.C. family, a unique one, I dare say, after reading the book. And it's a story of place, our beloved District of Columbia as well. It covers a number of decades, particularly displaying the impact of both policy, the economics, the social structure that surround us, and an encounter with the criminal justice system. Families struggle and strive to do the best they can in any situation, in any place. Washington, D.C. certainly offered distinct challenges that are probably reflective of the rest of the country as well. Again, Ms. Levy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, David.
We're deep into the plot, but there's definitely a background here. And your father is a very, very central figure in your story, of course. And in one regard, he's a product of a migration, if not a great migration, a migration within the region. The book reveals that he grew up in La Plata, Maryland, under different circumstances, given the year of his birth and the years of his childhood, and he made his way to Washington, D.C. Can you begin to tell us a little bit about your dad and his start in life, why so important to who he became as your father?
Yeah, so my dad grew up in Southern Maryland, as you say, very rooted there. I think there is a very distinct history of that region. Those of us from the Mid-Atlantic know that. I feel like when you talk about slavery and the aftermath of slavery, people always think about the Deep South, but racism was like very entrenched there. And I feel, you know, from him sharing stories of his childhood, it seemed like not much had really changed for Black people in that part of the country. And so he grew up pretty impoverished. His mother was very young when she had him, and for economic reasons was, you know, forced to leave him with his grandparents. And she went to DC and worked as a domestic to kind of support the family and I'm sure send money home. And he made his way to DC as a teenager, as a young man. His grandfather was like a very influential figure for him. He died when my father was about 14 years old. It was a very traumatic loss for him. I know that, you know, he encountered some things like there was a lynching that happened in Princess Anne when he was about 8 years old. I had found out about this in law school because I was studying the anti-lynching movement, and I came across this man's name, George Armwood. And I asked my dad, I was like, oh, do you remember anything about lynching? And he, you know, he had dementia at that point. He was in his 70s and he remembered the man's name. And that was the first time we actually like spoke about it. You know, I know he had just a very difficult childhood. He dealt with a lot of things. He had to grow up really fast. And then he ended up as a radio man in World War II, and he served in the Pacific Theater. He was a very, very brilliant, very charismatic, very handsome, loved to dress, dressed to the nines. He loved Shakespeare. He loved education. He believed so wholeheartedly in education. And that was like his big goal in life, I think, is to make sure that, you know, all of his children had as much opportunity as they could. He's really like larger than life kind of figure in my life and other people's lives.
Yeah. And my understanding that part of all this character was he had gentle times with his grandfather.
And, yes.
And I think, if I dare say, I'll presume upon the book, that gave him the impulse about the importance of education. And
yes.
And also the importance of one's own agency, which is going to show up in more of our story in your sharing, no doubt. You mentioned Shakespeare. He readily quoted Shakespeare around you and to you as well. But there's a wonderful, conflation is not the right word, but your mother played a role of her own and a role that was complementary to all that. Can you tell us a little bit about your mother's background? And then, of course, the two of them meld together. And if you please, just have at it as far as what you want to share with us.
Yeah, so my mother was, she was really, really an amazing person. She grew up, and she was born in the late 30s. She grew up in an immigrant family, Eastern European Jewish. They came here in the 20s, and, you know, native Washingtonian. She knew everything about the city. Like, it was actually like a little funny. Like, I felt like she was in some ways the historian of the family. And she was very beautiful. I think people were just, you know, very taken with her. And so she ended up in this sort of numbers world because her first husband, who was a Jewish man, he was a bookie. And so, you know, they were married after she was in high school. She went to college. And I grew up in that, actually, the house off of 16th and Military, where her family had eventually moved. And so I think because she was in that world already, it was easy for her to meet my father. And she saw him one day on Florida Avenue, and she's like, "Ooh, who's this man?" So, you know,
dapperly dressed in sartorial splendor. No.
Yes. Yes. And I'm sure the same with her. So, you know, they made a pair, and they went through some very hard times in the 70s with him being incarcerated and her being pregnant with me. And, you know, there is a reveal in the third part of the book about like the role that she played in the business. I won't give that all away because I want people to pick up and read the book. But yeah, it's definitely, and it's a story that I did not quite expect to find. I think that was like one of the bigger surprises, the role that she played and the documentation of that role. Yeah.
You mentioned that she thoroughly enjoyed and knew Washington, D.C. It stood out to me that the Coolidge High School of her time was not the Coolidge High School that is near me today.
Correct.
And which is mostly black and brown students. But in her time, it was a mishmash of immigrants that weren't black and brown. And it had a smattering of a lot of DC demographics. I wonder if you can just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so she graduated in 56. So, you know, obviously desegregation of the schools was lagging behind. I forgot the name of the companion case to Brown that desegregated DC public schools, but there were a few, a very, very few Black students, because I have her yearbook. It's like really interesting to see. So you see all these, you know, Italian, Jewish, Greek names. And it was really interesting to me because it's not like she ever mentioned this to me, but I found it after she passed away. And there's one Black female student there. And she'd written a message to my mother. And I kind of was like, I don't know, very curious about this, because I'm thinking how lonely and isolated the student must have been. And like, what was her relationship to my mother? And like, was she the kind of person at that early stage in her life where she was actually welcoming and open to non-white people? And it almost makes me see like how she ended up being my mother, but and then she,
yeah, with your really, dad who's Black Catholic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Also, you led on, and I don't want to spoil it for your book either, that her mother was very socially conscious about marginalization of different kinds of people, so I'm assuming that was at play as well.
Yeah, I mean, the immigrant experience is interesting because I think, you know, she had this otherness about her. But at the same time, these communities could be pretty insular. So I think it was, you know, it was difficult for her mother to accept the marriage that my parents had. Like, first of all, marrying somebody who's not Jewish, but also marrying somebody who's Black.
Just speaking in general, did family and friends provide welcome comfort? I'm thinking of, you know, of course, they're marrying around the time of the Loving case over in Virginia. So,
So I felt like my mother always felt comfortable, like on the Black side of things, and she was embraced by the community. And I think, you know, she had the relationships and also the friendships she had, you know, mostly were Black women. So I saw that growing up. I don't really know until I went to school, and I went to Sidwell. I didn't really have a deep connection to the Jewish community in DC, which has its own like very distinctive history. But that was kind of like my first encounter with a lot of people from, you know, that side of DC, I guess.
And we're coming up very quickly on the halfway point of our show, but could you say something about your extended family or your step siblings and such? What was family? We're only going to begin to introduce this. We'll follow it up in the second half of the show. But what was your bearing? I know you had sisters that related to you and stuff. What was life like for you kids, as folks would say?
Yeah, it was a little strange for me because I'm so much younger than a lot of my siblings. And so, you know, I'm now in my late 40s and I had siblings who were in their 70s. And so, you know, in some ways, my sisters almost felt like aunts to me growing up. And that those relationships have evolved as I am now well into my adulthood. But, you know, as a little kid, and I think that also added to like my curiosity about, you know, my family and my parents, because I felt like everyone knew more than I did. And I was always kind of like following behind, you know?
Well, I also know that the numbers community played a role as far as family and friends in a welcoming space. And we'll pursue that a little bit more in our discussion. But I do have a surprise for you that offers a break where we do public service announcements. But before we do that, a little special treat for you and our listeners. And then we'll have public service announcements and we'll rejoin our conversation with Janisa Matthews Levy and talking about her book, Numbers Up, Cracking the Code of an American Family, right after this.
Home Rule Music and the Film Preservation Foundation present the 5th Annual Home Rule Music Festival at the Parks at Walter Reed on Saturday, June 20th, 2026, including the Sun Ra Orchestra, Chuck Brown Band, Trouble Funk, and Melanie Charles. The event will also include a record fair, activities for children, local food vendors, and community activations. Details at homerulemusicfestival.com.
The DC Metro chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace presents the No to Nationalism Concert and Craft Market in solidarity with the people of Gaza and migrant communities here on Saturday, July 4th, 12 to 5 p.m. at Rhizome, DC. An afternoon of bands and DJs, including the Freedom Futures Collective, DJ Underdog, Leon City Sounds, and more. Details at rhizomedc.org.
Oh, and welcome back. And we'll come with our special treat in just a moment. We're talking to Janisa Matthews Levy. I've been saying Levy, forgive my New York prejudice here. I'll disavow it right away. And
all good. Thank you.
Okay. And I think any moment, clumsily as I'm doing this, we'll hear that treat. I want to fulfill my promise to you and the listeners. It's a piece of a Washington that we know quite well. And oh, okay. And you know what? I'm going to tell Control that we'll end on that treat, okay, instead of our closing theme, so we can proceed with our conversation. If I could, I tell listeners that there are plenty of good reasons to listen to WPFW throughout on a particular Wednesday at 1 o'clock. There's Africa Now with host Moesa Mutale, dealing with African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, covering matters of politics, history, environment, culture, and history, and then some. At 2 o'clock, Zen El Amin covers Middle Eastern affairs on Shewanana, and what I understand to be the oldest women's collective in public broadcasting. Sophie's Parlor comes to you presenting music and culture by women, but for everyone from 3 to 5. And to backtrack, immediately after this show, every noontime hour during the week, we don't forget the blues. We celebrate the blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner on Wednesdays. All that and more, thanks to you, the listener, for supporting this station for over 49 years. Janisha, did I?
Perfect.
Okay.
Yes.
again, thank you for sharing with your family story, but also a particular piece of Washington history. What I've overlooked are two things. Since we've been talking about folks and people and relationships, what was the numbers community like? As a reader, I found that there were older people who were friendly and kind and made up a sense of community. But what was that experience like for you? Was it the same?
Yeah, it really was. I have a really fond memories of, you know, the guys who worked, and they were mostly guys. There was one woman that I was very close to in particular. You know, they come over the house all the time, hang out. We go, like, my mom and I, because my dad did not drive. We would go pick him up every day, you know, on 14th Street, and they kind of hang in the car window and talk to us a little bit. And, you know, they were these men who were just that. Really dressed well most of the time, and they had like these really nice cars, and they'd have them shined up and, you know, come by the house. But there was a lot of like camaraderie and just, you know, joking and laughter and just storytelling. So I really loved that about the numbers community. And not many
and they were philanthropists and
people are alive right yeah. now. You know, that's also why I wanted to tell this story, because this generation is disappearing.
Yeah, I'm sorry I interrupted, but they played the role of philanthropy within the community often.
For sure. You know, they made money off of this, but you know, there was also a human element to the numbers, I think, that we don't have with the current lottery system. And so if you knew one of your customers was in trouble, you break them off a little bit and help them, or, you know, do things through the church. My family is very active at St. Augustine's, the Catholic Church in D.C., especially my grandmother. So, you know, that was a source of, like my dad's generosity. And, yeah, it, you know, it filled a space because there weren't a lot of options. At least in DC, we had, you know, a black owned bank, and that's still around. But a lot of times, you know, the numbers were used to in Colin Powell's family. That was you know, how his family was able to purchase a home because they hit the number. So, you know, it made a difference.
He says that in his book. I just want to make it clear to listeners. See, that's something he publicly put out there. Well, your reflection on this and the community that surrounded you reminds me, you said, you know, your father was a radio man and had done time in the Navy during World War II. But yet the benefits of, two main benefits of the GI Bill weren't offered to him. Continuous education through federal aid and home buying. And so he, like other black men and women, were subject to a tremendous structural problem, a barrier, if you will.
Yes.
The number system was a way to navigate that, right? Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a wealth building opportunity. It was a way to have some sort of autonomy. You know, occupational autonomy is like very important. And especially in black communities during like their segregation, you had people who are basically, and there's a professor who's written about survivalist entrepreneurship. Her name's LaShawn Harris. And so I think, you know, you may have a lot of people had jobs in the formal economy, but they also did things on the side. To make ends meet. I think my dad just decided he was going to like entirely opt out of the system. I know at one point he worked for the government printing office and he had some other jobs, but you know, he had a large family, a growing family. And so I think he wanted more for himself, and more stability. And this for a time offered that. You know, it didn't last, but for a time, it definitely paid the bills. And, you know, it educated his kids. Like, we all went to Catholic schools and private schools in D.C.
Like Sidwell, yeah. And also, your mom and dad made sure you partake of the finest things of culture, concerts, cultural
yes.
events.
Mm-hmm. Played violin for a very long time, you know, had lessons, and yeah, they were loved to take us to plays and musicals, and you know, grew up going to the Kennedy Center because I had like a real love of music. My dad had a love of theater, and so we definitely took advantage of that, you know, that all of the offerings in DC. And
one micro question with that, did he in some ways prove to you that some people believe that Shakespeare's universal, at least universally accessible or universally relevant? Do you think that was the case? I mean, the oftentimes quoting Shakespeare to you must have had some effect.
Yeah, in the beginning, it was kind of really, really, to be honest, it was really irritating. But I grew up, you know, I found that I really loved the study of English literature and writing, and especially in college. I had to take some core offerings, and some of those were Shakespeare classes. And so I had read some Shakespeare in high school, but I think that's when it really opened my eyes. you know, started to appreciate some of the universality of it. Although, you know, I have since done some studying on the kind of like racial tropes and other things that are, so Othello, are in for his instance, plays. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's complicated, you know, it's a complicated legacy there, but yeah, he, you know, and he also just loved like poetry and reciting. My dad loved to recite poetry too, and he had a really great voice for it, and I think, and so it was interesting to me to learn more about Odessa Madre, because I felt like they had these similarities. So, you know, Odessa went to Dunbar, and she felt like she was an outcast because she was a darker skinned woman. And I think my dad felt that acutely too, because he told me about, you know, having this girlfriend in La Plata and how the family didn't approve of him. And I think, you know, she also won oratory contest. And so she also had that like appreciation and intelligence, you know, and that's what I really want people to know in this book. It's, if I may read this, if it doesn't get too long, it's just a short little, quote, the thing we term it hustle, but it's really just the ingenuity necessary to survive and navigate in the world. It's still wisdom. It's still knowledge. It's still invention. It's still development. It's still progress. And we can acknowledge soul in the academic space and brilliance in the streets. And this was something Lauryn Hill said, and it really, you know, kind of gets to the core of the story too.
Yeah, and it's very much applicable to your dad and to Miss Madre as well.
Yes.
Some quick remarks about all that. I said to you in our interview conversation, entrepreneurship is admired in American culture, but entrepreneurial enterprise isn't granted to Black and Brown people at all. And this hustle quote that you just mentioned really talks about making a way out of no way or navigating things. Yet you share that from time to time, law enforcement, as well as eventually some of elected officials or politicians, had an admiration for the number system. And so trying to realize the economy of time here. The numbers, if you watch old Hollywood movies, for instance, they're movies that campaign against the numbers. But there's never a direct racial reference, but there are allusions in these old films, especially film noir. But they were periodically, when it was convenient for political campaigns, pursuits of the numbers game, and particularly people of color. And so you have a facility, Lorton, and we haven't talked about that. Can you just quickly describe Lorton as in terms of how it developed and in your father's time?
Yeah, so Lorton, I think, dates from around 1910. And it steadily grew. It was built by people who were the inmates. And, you know, at first, I think it was used as like for nonviolent offenders. And there's this whole, you know, suffragette history where they had.
That's where they were held.
They were held there and they were force fed. But then it became this kind of like sprawling place. You know, by the 70s, it was overcrowded. Yeah, it was a huge campus. You know, there were people who were, you know, committed felonies, were there. There were different wings. And so, You know, my dad was there at the kind of the height of that, and he, I believe, would have been held in, they called it, it was like a part of the prison for elderly folks who were just people over 43. So I guess I would be considered an elderly folk at this point. But, you know, it, eventually Lorton was closed. It was this huge, like, political fight over it. And it was redeveloped as this community called Liberty Crest, which is, like, super ironic. But also, there's a part of it that's really creepy and eerie, because I believe that spirits, you know, you can still feel the spirits of the suffering.
And some of the signs aren't changed, right? And
no, they're still
memorialization
there.
Is not, it's very incomplete, is it not?
Right. Mm-hmm. The guard towers mm-hmm. are still there, mm-hmm. kind of like looming mm-hmm. over. And yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those places mm-hmm. where you feel the vibrations.
All right. Well, I wanted to be deliberate, and I got a sense in talking to you and trying to prepare some important, there are two important things. One, the influence of Bryan Stevenson on your anti-death penalty work and your legal internships as you were becoming a lawyer. But two, this whole idea of remembrance and telling one's story, whether it's out of individual identity or family, those two things are important. So what I've tried to do is just put those two things together for you to talk about. Let's start out with the influence of you becoming the lawyer that you are. And then let's end with the importance of remembrance and how it applies, or how you want your writing to work.
Yeah, so I became very interested in the anti-death penalty movement after college. And so that, you know, was really, really kind of decisive in, like, where I went to law school. I ended up going to NYU. I knew Bryan Stevenson at that time. It was like in the early 2000s. He was doing the work without the spotlight at that time. So people in that community knew about him, but he was not like the household name that he is now. And he had a clinic, a legal clinic, that students participated in, at the last, in their last year, where you would basically live in Alabama and you would work on the appeal for an inmate on death row. And it was, I think it was a window into experiencing some of what my dad must have experienced growing up. There were some, like, eerie parallels between his existence and you know, my client's early childhood. And so, and I think the two questions are really connected, because, you know, one thing that's very important to Bryan Stevenson is narrative. And that's why he's invested so much in that. Yes, you know, he's still doing the anti-death penalty work, but, you know, the sculpture garden and the remembrance of, like, the lynchings and the incarceration museum that he has, he's telling the story of what happened in America to Black bodies and Black people, and bringing that to light. And I think right now, especially in this cultural moment, Black people, we finally have the tools, you know, to tell, in the research, to tell our stories more fully. And people are afraid of that truth coming out. And
May I add, they're even trying to wipe out the evidence.
So important. Yeah. They're trying to suppress and wipe out the evidence because they don't want to examine the complicated. They don't want to have to confront the complicated history of this country. And so right now, I think telling stories in any form you can is a political act, but it's also something that I think is important for our souls. So I like beg people, I'm like, please get your family stories, like while you have the time. And I know sometimes elders are like a little hesitant to relive certain things, but if you can get them to talk, I think you will learn so much from them.
Well, what our audience can't see, but only hear from us, is the use of your family photographs and photographs of different people of the age of Washington during your parents' time and during your growing up. You pretty much insinuate in your book, but you just said just now that documents are important, family photos are important, and then asking the questions as you did. It's just pursuing a curiosity that has its rewards. Is it not?
Yes. And I'm still learning things even after this book, you know, a cousin, a newly discovered cousin that I went to school with at Tidwell. We did not know we were related, and he discovered that we were. And he also found that my two times great grandfather, I had heard this, you know, story passed down from my dad that he had fought in the U.S. colored troops during the Civil War. And so Ben was able to discover his name, his pension record. Like, I have all these details now about this ancestor. And I can't tell you how much it meant to find out that information. It's like these people become real, you know, when you know what they lived through.
And it may be a commonplace, but they're larger than life, and they offer something to our lives even when they're physically gone from us.
Absolutely.
So we've been talking to Janissa Matthews Levy.
Perfect.
And her book, Numbers Up, The Cracking of the Code of an American Family, is indeed an important story, not only for her life, but for Washingtonians. So I'm happy you've been very much with us and that you shared. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. My thanks to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, to Brian Bernard, engineering our hour. And as promised, a little bit of Washington that's been relevant to our story. Here's Chuck Brown playing with the Thievery Corporation, The Numbers Game. Take care. My thanks to you, the listeners, for always supporting WPFW. You make a difference. Thank you again. Take care. Loaded.
Music is the very cement that has not just held the Black community together, but holds Black selves together in a fundamental sense. The words of Dr. Cornel West. On Saturday, June 20th, from midnight until midnight, WPFW presents Black Music Matters, celebrating the genius of the music, a foundational pillar of global culture and a profound vehicle for both struggle and triumph, lauded for its ceaseless evolution and its ability to act as a mirror for cultural and political history and movement. We have secured a $10,000 challenge grant in honor of the importance of Black music and are asking that you help us meet the challenge on that day. Black Music Matters. Saturday, June 20th, midnight to midnight on WPFW. Building a better world, one soulful track at a time. The WPFW Local Station Board is having their regular monthly meeting on Wednesday, June 17th, beginning at 6:30 p.m. The board will hear from management concerning programming and special events, as well as committee reports on recent actions and activities. The meeting has set aside time for community comment beginning at 8 p.m. to hear directly from you, our listeners. More information about our local station board and a Zoom link to the meeting may be found online at wpfwfm.org. WPFW, changing the world one conversation at a time.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.